Blog Talk Radio.
So I'm gon' drop you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the last real nigga left, the left. It's like I'm on an island by myself, the left.
What's up, bitches? Good googly moogly. I'm telling you, I'm never gonna get sick of that. I will never, ever, ever get sick of that. It's just so perfect. It's just so perfect. The best entrance ever. So I'm excited. I'm excited for today's show. That's all I got to tell you. Donald Trump made his selection for Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he nominated the swamp. Drain the swamp, do this, do that. I'm against corruption. I'm anti-establishment. Yeah, no, not even close. You nominated. He's basically trying to be Hillary Clinton, and watching the Trump bots just fucking fall all over themselves rationalizing this pick has been hilarious. So we're going to talk about that. In fact, I'm going to lead with that story. Then as we move along here, we got Trump deciding on his Secretary of Health and Human Services. Yet again, horrific pick. So I will be going in. And then the story I probably most can't wait for today is super obscure. In fact, many of you might not even know who the fuck this guy is, but, you know, I'll explain it for you. David Brooks is a New York Times writer, and he is the biggest hack pseudo-intellectual that there's ever been. And he wrote an article about the new center and how they should respond after this election. And I am just going to rip that article to shreds because it is just the dumbest thing I've ever read in my life. So he bemoans, oh, you have extremists on both sides, Donald Trump on one side and Bernie Sanders on another side. If only there was somebody who was more pro-establishment. Yes, we had that person. Her name was Hillary Clinton, David. But we'll talk about all that and more. And then later on in the show, we have Fox News hosts bravely standing up to those goddamn powerful minimum wage workers. Oh, what are we going to do? What are we going to do with these people, man? It's ridiculous. Okay, let's get started. And we got some Donald Trump picks to talk about now, don't we? Donald Trump made his selection for Secretary of Health and Human Services, and he went with Republican representative and former orthopedic surgeon Tom Price. So here's what you need to know about this pick. It's terrible. No, it really is. So I'll explain exactly why. So first of all, this is a guy who wants to repeal Obamacare. And in fact, he's been on the front lines of that battle. Now, I need everybody to keep in mind just how extreme Republicans have been on this issue. Because when, you know, during Obama's time in office and when the Democrats maintained control of the Senate, you still had the Republicans try over 60 times to repeal Obamacare. Now, I mean, it wasn't going to work, clearly, because the Democrats have the Senate, and Obama's not going to sign away one of his signature pieces of legislation, but it shows you something about the Republicans. They're like fucking vicious, fierce dogs. They just keep attacking, keep attacking, keep attacking. They don't care about the logic of the situation. They don't care that it has no chance of actually working. He's like, I don't care. It's the right thing to do. I'm just going to keep doing it. Now, by the way, contrast that with the Democrats. When the Democrats have over 90% of the American people with them on a universal background check bill, what do? They propose it once. And then they go home and cry when it gets slapped down by the Republicans. Mitch McConnell bragged about slapping that bill down. You didn't hear any peep at any Democrats afterwards. Are you kidding me? He just handed you a gift. He slapped the American people in the face and said, I'm against universal background checks after kids were slaughtered at Sandy Hook. And the Democrats were like, oh, okay, I guess we'll move on to a different topic. What are you doing? Meanwhile, when the Republicans are fighting a battle, they know they're going to lose. They keep fighting. Well, Tom Price, now Trump wants this guy as Secretary of Health and Human Services. He's massively against Obamacare, but that ain't it. So he's also massively anti-abortion, massively anti-gay rights. He is against Planned Parenthood. In fact, he has a rating of 0% from Planned Parenthood and 100% from the NRA. But the most important fact, not only does he want to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, he also wants to privatize Medicare. Now, for the Secretary of Health and Human Services, remember, this person has power in these fields. So all the talk on the campaign trail from Donald Trump during the primary and the general election of, I'm going to protect your Social Security, I'm going to protect your Medicare. I mean, look, I'm not against those programs. Every other Republican bobblehead idiot on stage, whether it was Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush or me, Ted Cruz, they all across the board said, no, we got to reform Social Security to make it viable for the future. These are all code words for cutting and or privatizing. Donald Trump was the one Republican who stood up and said, I'm not going to cut it. I'm not going to cut it. I'm just not going to cut it. So, but now what's he doing? He's appointing people for different powerful positions that want to do exactly that. We also discussed his pick for the Social Security Administration, one of his picks for the Social Security Administration. They want to privatize it. So again, he says, I don't want to do it. Well, then why are you appointing people who want to do it and, in fact, have made it their mission to do it? Why are you appointing somebody who's not only against Obamacare, which, I know you are too, but he's also against Medicare and against Medicaid? Dude, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, but see, this is why Donald Trump was a fucking wild card, because I told you, he'll either be the most establishment candidate ever, because he'll get in there and realize he's over his head and say, okay, I'll just defer to people around me. And who's going to be around him? Right-wing establishment people. It's either going to be that, or it's going to be the most bullheaded authoritarian person ever who goes off every impulse. Now, it turns out it's looking like more of a mix of those two things, but this is like the worst-case scenario. And understand the plan to replace Obamacare. What is it? Listen to this genius move. Get rid of Obamacare, replace it with tax cuts. What does that even mean? Like, okay, no, we got it. We got the solution on this one, guys. It's cool. It's cool. Tax cuts. Has there ever been a Republican, a problem that Republicans didn't answer with tax cuts? And by the way, remember, 98% of the time, it's not a tax cut for you. It's a tax cut for the rich. Now, there's a rare instance where it might be more than just rich people, but that's not going to solve the problem. The idea that's it. Okay, we solved it. We just gave people tax cuts. Okay, then what about the fact that you just repealed Obamacare, which means millions more people will be uninsured? We already have millions of people uninsured. 45,000 people die every year because they don't have access to basic health care. How are you going to fix all that other stuff? The prices, through the fucking roof. There's price gouging going on. We cover the stories about a hospital in Florida where they'll give you tissues. If you use them, they bill you like a couple $100 and call it a cough suppressant aid. I mean, this is a grotesque system. How do you plan on fixing that? How do you plan on fixing all this? They're like, oh, okay, so along with the tax cuts, what we're going to do is, get ready, bold, fresh ideas. We're going to get rid of the lines around the state so insurance companies can go to any state they want. Again, that's the Republican cure-all idea, but it doesn't cure dick. All that does, for those of you who don't know, it's a trick. This policy is a trick. It makes it so that all the health insurance companies will simply go to the one state that offers them the lowest tax rate. That's it. So it's a way for them to pad their bottom line. They'll pretend like, oh, it'll lower costs for you massively. Maybe initially up front they'll go, okay, here, since we're paying less in taxes, we'll pass off the savings to our customers. But then 2 years later they jack it right back up and they're like, whoa, what are you talking about? So it's just another trick to pad the bottom line, and the Republican politicians are either in on the con job, or they're idiots, and they just think, no, that really will cure it. So this is a terrible, terrible, terrible pick. Bernie Sanders released a statement on this, calling this just incredible hypocrisy from Trump. Oh, I'm going to protect these programs. I'm going to protect them. Anyway, let me put people in charge who want to do the exact opposite. So Donald Trump, what was that thing you said about a swamp again? Because I think what you're doing now is bathing in it. Okay. Next. do, bitch. Speaking of the swamp, let's continue. On the topic of the swamp, Donald Trump decided to nominate the swamp for Treasury Secretary. That's really not much of an exaggeration. He went with a guy named Steve Mnuchin, whose name itself is fucking annoying. Mnuchin. Don't put an MN and N back to back. Don't do that. Why would you do that? It's just obnoxious. So what do you need to know about this guy? Well, Mnuchin is a second-generation Goldman Sachs partner. Ha-ha! Double swamp for you. So Daddy was there, and then he decided when he grows, I want to be just like Daddy and fucking ruin people's lives too. Now understand, why is that important? Well, number one, he campaigned on, I'm massively anti-establishment, I'm against, you know, the people on Wall Street, and now he's appointing the quintessential people on Wall Street. But furthermore, Goldman Sachs was actually probably the worst offender on Wall Street. I mean, there were a lot of fucking crimes happening there. But as Bernie Sanders said during the primary, rightly so, fraud was their business model. So for those of you who don't understand the dynamics and what went down, right before the subprime mortgage crisis and the Great Recession, what Goldman Sachs would do is they would sell packages, subprime mortgage packages, by the way, rated like AAA. So people, oh my God, these are so good, because they also bought off the ratings agencies, another con job, another scam that was part of this. But they would sell it to unsuspecting clients, and they would say, look, man, you're going to make a lot of money. You just got to trust me. I'm the expert here. Hey, I work for Goldman Sachs. Big name, know what I'm saying? So anyway, you're gonna buy these packages, and you're going to make a lot of money, and you're going to retire, and you're going to have a huge nest egg in there, and you're going to make millions of dollars. Simple as that. So they sell the packages like that. Then they turn around and bet on those same packages that they just sold as awesome to fail. So they knew it was bullshit. They knew the packages were going to go belly up. They knew the economy was fucked. They didn't care. They made money two ways. Lying to people, saying, hey, this is great when they know it's not great, and then betting on that product to fail. You couldn't come up with a more textbook definition of fraud. That is fraud 101. It's not even close. There's no other fucking interpretation of it. That's what it is. So what does Mr. Drain the Swamp do? Yeah, let me take that guy and put him as Treasury Secretary. Are you mental? And the saddest thing, all yesterday, so I tweeted about this yesterday. By the way, all I did was put facts in the tweet. That's it. I said, so Donald Trump picked a Goldman Sachs guy for a Treasury Secretary, and I said a few other little facts in the tweet, and people go, there were Trump people who were going, yeah, oh yeah? No, he's just appointing somebody who's competent in the job. Oh my God, you guys are so sad. Oh my God, you're rationalizing for Daddy Trump in real time. Do you have no idea how stupid you look? I mean, think about it. If fucking Hillary Clinton nominated Mnuchin with the obnoxious M and the N back-to-back, would all the Trump people go, oh, it's cool. It's, yeah, whatever, you're competent in the position. No, they go, oh, my God, corrupt Hillary Clinton. Oh, my God, Hillary Clinton. And by the way, it would have been corrupt if she picked him, too, and I would have went after her, too, as my fucking track record shows, because I'm actually consistent on the issues. So the point is, don't be a partisan hack, dipshit, loyalist prick, because you look like an idiot because you are an idiot. Try this thing out called consistency, where you actually care about the issues and you actually care about the American people. And it doesn't matter. I don't care who proposes good ideas or bad ideas. If it's a good idea, I'm going to tell you it's a good idea. If it's a bad idea, I'm going to tell you it's a bad idea, because I'm not a fucking toddler. More on this guy. He worked for George Soros. Now, it's the Republicans who tell me every day he's the worst of the worst of the different billionaires. You know, they do apologetics, all the Koch brothers, whatever, they're all into oil and gas, and we love that, so don't worry about them. George Soros. George Soros. How many times has Bill O'Reilly mentioned George Soros on his show? I think he has a segment daily called George Soros. That's an exaggeration, but you get my point. But now that this guy picked somebody who worked for George Soros, now that Trump does that, George Soros, whoever said we were against George Soros, Furthermore, he started a hedge fund. You couldn't make a list of a worse person for Treasury Secretary. And he also, you ready, bought IndyMac. Now, IndyMac was a failing California bank during the subprime mortgage crisis. And he renamed it One West and made billions of dollars foreclosing on old people's houses. I have nothing else to say other than he is the swamp. Apparently, the new motto, the new slogan for the Trump people, what they'll say to Daddy Trump now is, please drain the swamp in my mouth. Next. Fucking joke this is. Okay, now I do have to give you some good news. I do have some good news for you, so there's that. There's that. We have some good news here for you about jobs, the Hill explains for us. The Donald Trump team and Carrier, the air conditioning company, have reached an agreement to keep about 1,000 manufacturing jobs in Indiana, fulfilling one of Trump's major campaign promises. Carrier confirmed the news, first reported by the New York Times, on Twitter. They said, we are pleased to have reached a deal with President-elect Trump and VP-elect Pence to keep close to 1,000 jobs in Indiana. More details soon. In March, they announced they would close their facility in Indianapolis and move operations to Mexico, eliminating 1,400 jobs. The deal reportedly will keep a majority of the jobs in the state in exchange for friendlier business regulations and an overhauling of the corporate tax code. Trump is also expected to tone down his rhetoric, threatening 35% tariffs on companies that shift production out of the country. Okay, so I have many thoughts on this. First of all, you have to give credit where credit is due. He said repeatedly on the campaign trail, I'm going to get Carrier to keep their jobs here. I'm going to get Carrier to keep their jobs here. And he used them as a prime example of everything that's wrong with American companies outsourcing their jobs and screwing over the American people. So 100%, give him credit for it. Good job. And if you don't give him credit for it, you're kind of being a partisan loyalist hack asshole. And you're kind of just saying, whatever Trump does, I don't care. I'm going to hate on him, even if it's something that's unquestionably positive. So let's be consistent here. Fantastic job. I'm happy that they're keeping their jobs in the country. Now, with that being said, there are caveats, because the devil's in the details, man. And what I read here is a little concerning. So it's not like he's getting them to keep their jobs here, and they're admitting, like, okay, not only am I going to keep the jobs here, but I get it. I'm going to do it because it's the right thing to do, and I'm financially incentivized to do it because you're going to basically, you know, put a tariff on me and make it worse if I ship the jobs out. That's not the case because, again, they said he's expected to back off of the tariff rhetoric. So what is the case? Well, they say it's going to be friendlier business regulations that allow them to keep the jobs here and overhauling of the corporate tax code. So, in other words, Trump got on the phone with them and Pence got on the phone with them, and they probably said something along the lines of, look, man, we're going to bend over and take it in the ass for you. So, you know, we're going to find a way where if we got to give you a backdoor, pun intended, subsidy, it is what it is. If we got to find a way to make it so that you save so much more on taxes and you pay so much fewer taxes that, you know, you're basically getting away with robbery, so be it. If we have to change safety regulations that you think are burdensome regulations but are actually necessary regulations, well, we'll change it because we're basically going to get on our hands and knees and grovel in order for you to keep the jobs here because we made the campaign promise and we want to come through on this and we want to make it look like we're, you know, fighting for the working class and we're really populists. So, again, the devil's in the details. I would love to see all of the specific provisions of this when eventually we learn about them. Now, Trump is going to do what is a brilliant political move soon, which he's going to go out and give a speech and brag about it. He's going to go out there and say, ah, ha, ha, I told you I'd do it, and I'm the best, and I care about the people. And by the way, a trick the Democrats never learn. Even when they do something good. Did Obama give a press conference and fucking do a victory lap on all the Sunday shows when he raised overtime pay for people? So So now instead of people making $23,000 and under, they get overtime pay. It was $47,000 and under. Did he do that? Did he go out there and do a victory lap when he said, "I freed nonviolent drug offenders," which is obviously the right thing to do, and you know, the overwhelming majority of the American people agree with me, and let me tell you how great I am. He didn't do that. Trump is doing something here, which, again, I'm going to say overall is a positive thing. I want those jobs to stay in the U.S., and he's going to give a speech. He's going to give a speech and say, "Aha, I'm great. Worship at the altar of me. Oh, I'm so tremendous. Believe me. Let me just tell you." So credit where credit is due. But you got to be reserved, you got to be nuanced, and you have to look at, you know, you got to give all the hedges and all the caveats, because the reality is what's in that deal matters. So what would I have done? Again, I would have made it crystal clear. I would have said, here's what's going to happen. If you ship those jobs overseas, we are going to make it so that it costs more for you, whether that's in the form of a tariff or anything else. We're going to make it so that you are financially incentivized to keep the jobs here, and no, I'm not going to let you keep the jobs here and give you favoritism and special deals and special breaks, because that would also be unfair to people here. So if at the end of the day, oh, you keep your jobs here, but then you're paying such a freakishly low tax rate that you're getting a giant subsidy, I'm not going to do that. You're a company. You need to pay your fucking taxes. I'm not going to have secretaries who make $50,000 a year, $40,000 a year pay more in taxes than your giant fucking company. That doesn't make sense. That would be a bias against them, a bias against working people, as ironically I claim I'm fighting for the working people. So no, what I'm going to do is I'm going to make you keep those jobs here, and I'm going to do it in a way where you abide by the laws. It appears like what they're going to do is say, you're going to keep the jobs here, but we're also going to take it in the ass for you because, hey, we'll do special favors as long as the end goal is reached, which is keep the jobs here by any means necessary. No, you got to make them keep the jobs here and still not give them a sloppy blowjob. I fear they're going to give them a sloppy blowjob in an unfair way. So anyway, overall, give them credit. Got to look at all the details of the deal when it comes out. That's the bottom line. Okay. Do-do-do-do-do-do, bitch. All right, let me go to the David Brock story because it is very, very, very important. This is my favorite story of the day, and I'm going to have so much fun with it. This segment might last forever. You'll see. Oh, I said David Brock. I meant David Brooks. I keep fucking that up. People on Twitter, too, they're like, wait, who are you talking about? You talking about Media Matters dude or no, the New York Times guy. Here, let's break it down. David Brooks is the most hilarious pseudo-intellectual hack of all time. He is, of course, a writer for the New York Times, and he is the deepest establishment prick in the country. He's so deep inside that bubble, and he's totally oblivious to the fact that he's within that bubble. So he wrote an article, and he did it about a new movement. Yes, a movement. Because, you know, David Brooks is the kind of person who can lead a movement. He has so much charisma. You have no idea. It's dripping from his pores. So let's make fun of this movement. Here's what he says. The most important caucus formation will be in the ideological center. There's a lot of room between the alt-right and the alt-left, between Trumpian authoritarianism and Sanders socialism. Until now, people in that space have been slow to create donor networks, slow to form think tanks, slow to build coalitions of moderate legislators, but suddenly there's a flurry of activity between the extremes. Okay, let's pause here and discuss this a little bit. That makes no sense. This ideological center he's talking about, you know what it is? The establishment. That ideological center is what Hillary Clinton represented. She was roundly defeated. The establishment Democrats and the establishment Republicans are this ideological center that he's talking about. And I love the massive false equivalence. Oh, my God, you got the far right with Donald Trump, crazy authoritarian. But the far left, Bernie Sanders, socialism. I mean, this is crazy. Really? We got a socialist guy here? I mean, you guys are nuts. We need to have a donor network for these people in the middle. That's where all the donor money is right now. Donald Trump raised less money than Hillary Clinton by a mile and a half. Bernie Sanders, he got all his money from the people. The actual big money donor network is already in the spot where you're saying it needs to be. in this goofy center, which is just establishment corporatism. All right, let me give you more. They say here, or he says here, for example, Bill Kristol, always hilarious when you reference Bill Kristol, and Bill Galston have worked in the White Houses of different parties and had voted for the opposite presidential candidate in every election for four decades. But Donald Trump has reminded them how much they agree on the fundamentals. The two bills have now issued a joint statement calling for a new center. It's a defense of the basic institutions and practices of our constitutional order, which now seem under assault. It's an attempt to learn from the election results and craft a governing philosophy that people of different parties can rally around. There is a raging need for a movement that embraces economic dynamism, global engagement, and social support. This is my favorite part of the article. You ready for this? He says, that is part Milton Friedman on economic policy, Ronald Reagan on foreign policy, and Franklin Roosevelt on welfare policy. The new center will probably start as a legislative caucus with members of both parties. Where it goes from there is anybody's guess. Well, actually, no, I have the answer. Where it goes from there is nowhere. Because, first of all, that doesn't make any sense. He says, okay, what we need is on Milton Friedman economic policy. Okay, Milton Friedman economic policy. Got it. And Ronald Reagan on foreign policy. Okay, so far you just described Ronald Reagan. That's all you described. Because Ronald Reagan is like Milton Friedman on economic policy. So we need Ronald Reagan on foreign policy and economic policy. And we need Franklin Roosevelt on economic policy. Okay, but that's contradictory. You can't be both Ronald Reagan and Franklin Roosevelt on economic policy. No, but I mean, Franklin Roosevelt on welfare policy. Okay, but again, that's a contradiction because Reagan was the polar opposite on welfare policy, economic policy, whatever you want to call it. Anything involving jobs, the economy, taxes, Ronald Reagan is the polar opposite of FDR. FDR, basically a social democrat, believed in, hey, you know, let's do Social Security. Let's make sure there's a safety net there for people. Let's do the New Deal and get people infrastructure jobs. Let the government be involved in the economy because it's the right thing to do. They should be the spender and employer of last resort. Ronald Reagan was, the scariest words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. That is fucking polar opposite. No, but see, this is why this guy is the biggest hack intellectual, pseudo-intellectual in politics. Because he's got everybody in Washington and New York duped, like, oh, David Brooks and his brilliant columns. What the fuck? He doesn't even know the basic terms. He doesn't even know when he's contradicting himself. And by the way, you want to talk about the actual center, the real center that can be proven by the numbers? You know who's in this new center? Bernie fucking Sanders. Because Bernie Sanders, when you look at what he believes issue by issue, you know, by doing an actual political analysis instead of being a bloviating, subjective asshole, you find out very quickly, oh, this guy represents the middle of the country. You pick the issue, I will show you how Bernie Sanders represents the will of the American people. There's only maybe one, two, three issues max out of dozens of issues where the American people are not with Bernie Sanders. So if the majority of the country is with Bernie Sanders, wouldn't that by definition be Bernie Sanders is in the center of the country? The answer is yes. And again, see, this is stuff, I mean, this guy, there's no analysis, there's no data, there's no actual discussion of issues. It's just vague talk about what he thinks is the far right, what he thinks is the far left, what he thinks needs to be the new center, and he thinks it's going to get traction. What's your message? You don't even have a message.
Well, what we need to do is inspire people and say the right is bad and the left is bad. And
they already tried this, by the way. There was a no labels movement that launched years ago. It went nowhere.
Like, see, we're just the problem solvers. We don't have any labels. We don't have any labels. Let me just tell you that right now.
Okay, but dude, what you're missing is this idea of, well, we just got to get away from the extremes. What does that assume? That assumes that the spectrum is sane in America, that the left represents a real left, that the right represents a real right. That's not the case. The spectrum in the U.S. is off the international spectrum. It's way off to the right. So the so-called liberals, the so-called Democrats and leftists in America, they're actually internationally kind of right-wing because we have two corporatist establishment parties. There is no real left, which is why people think Bernie Sanders is the real left, but Bernie Sanders is an international centrist. He just believes in social democracy. Virtually any other modern nation, people look at him, they go, that's the most moderate guy I've ever seen in my life. So there's no actual analysis of what's going on in the world and what our system represents and what our spectrum actually is, and let's go issue by issue. And there's no message to inspire people. It's just this vague talk, this generalized, sloppy thinking of, I don't know, Trump bad, Bernie bad, because I'm rich and I don't want him taxing me. New center. Let's set up this thing in the center of the country, which is cool with the corporations, and it's cool with rich people like me where we feel comfortable voting for them. And maybe we could call this group, this new center, the elite, or maybe the establishment. And maybe we could have somebody like a moderate that I like Hillary Clinton, represent it. And then obviously it'll go so well because people will love this person and be inspired by this person, and she'd win an election in a landslide. Oh, what? What? The opposite happened? Oh, that's unfortunate. Okay. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, got a lot more to get to. Obama spoke to Rolling Stone after the election and weighed in on why Democrats were unable to reach voters. And then the New York Times is reporting that Obama is expanding the war on terror. So we got all that and more. Stay right there, guys. We'll be right back. Thank you.
the left, the left. You will think so, I'm gon' dap you with the left, the left. I feel like I'm the lecturer, nigga, left, the left.
All right, we're back, y'all.
Boom. Let's keep going here. Got some stuff on Obama for you. All right, let's do it. President Obama spoke to Rolling Stone after the election, and he weighed in on why Democrats were unable to reach voters this election. Here's his explanation. He says, "The challenge is people are getting 100 different visions of the world from 100 different outlets or 1,000 different outlets, and that is ramping up divisions. It's making people exaggerate or say what's most controversial or peddling in the most vicious of insults or lies because that attracts eyeballs. In this election, white working class voters turned out in huge numbers for Trump, and I think that part of it has to do with our inability, our failure, to reach those voters effectively. Part of it is Fox News in every bar and restaurant in big chunks of the country, but part of it is also Democrats not working at a grassroots level, being in there, showing up, making arguments. That part of the critique of the Democratic Party is accurate. We spend a lot of time focused on international policy and national policy and less time being on the ground, and when we're on the ground, we do well." Okay, so that's partly true. Yes, Fox News is poison. It's toxic propaganda. They don't give a fuck about truth, and their whole purpose is Democrats evil, Republicans good, end of conversation. So that's partly true, and propaganda is effective. But there's also a whole other aspect to it. Now, he touched on it here barely, but he didn't get into enough detail. So he said, yeah, okay, we weren't able to reach white working class voters. But, there's always a but. But it's just because we're not out there enough. No, that's not it. In fact, the reality is TPP, Wall Street connections, corruption, the fact that you now represent the establishment. Look, when Obama ran, he ran on change. And, you know, people looked at this young black guy who basically represented the antithesis of George W. Bush, and they said, oh, that's exactly what we want now because fuck George W. Bush. Two unnecessary wars, put it on the credit card, exploded the debt and the deficit, the economy tanked. He's just a mess. He was a mess. So anything but a Republican, anything but that kind of person. And Obama came along at the right time, and with a center-leftish kind of message, people went, oh, my God, I love it. I love it. He's talking about change. He's talking about ending the corruption. Remember, people forget this. Obama hammered Hillary Clinton in the primaries over NAFTA because she supported NAFTA. And he was like, that's a terrible idea. No, NAFTA was bad, and I wouldn't do these trade deals. Well, fast forward years later, now he's pushing for TPP endlessly, and he defends it endlessly. So, but Obama, that's the problem. If you actually go to the electoral map and you look at the counties and the areas in the country that decided the election for Donald Trump, the Democratic firewall fell. Now, in that Democratic firewall are white working class people in former factory towns who got their fucking job shipped overseas or just shipped out of the country. So, and Bill Clinton signed NAFTA. So they look at him and then they look at Hillary. They're like, why the fuck would I vote for you? Whereas Trump, every speech, oh, I'm against TPP. Oh, NAFTA was horrible. Oh, crooked Hillary, crooked, crooked, crooked. She's corrupt. Look at the money she's taking from the politicians. So even though Trump, now that he's in there, and he just fucking appointed Steve Mnuchin, a Goldman Sachs guy, to be Treasury Secretary. So even though he's in there, he's going back on everything he said. But his rhetoric on the campaign trail was more fucking populist than the Democrats. And that's what you're missing. It's not just that you're not out there. That's his criticism of Hillary Clinton. No, she wasn't out there making the argument enough. True, but what was the argument? What do you stand for? And you, Obama, went from talking about change, fundamental change, 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 to now that you've been president, well, maybe incremental is the way to go. Maybe we take little steps here and there, and maybe that's as far as we can go, because maybe we have to be realistic about the system. This was his attack on Bernie Sanders. This is what he said about Bernie Sanders. Well, you know, he doesn't understand the reality of what it's really like to be in this office, where obviously you have to cave to Republicans all the time and give Wall Street what they want, at least some of the time. Well, that's why you lost, because you and Hillary Clinton. Remember, when Donald Trump was out arguing Make America Great Again, what was their counterpoint? America is already great. Is that something that's going to resonate with the guy who just lost his factory job? You know, he's been unemployed for a while. He can't, it's hard for him to afford fucking Christmas presents for his kids. Is that a message? Oh, we're already great. Wonderful. Well, I don't feel fucking great. No, you have to attack. You have to talk about the issues that affect people's lives, and you forgot about that. You know, you guys went out there and just cliches and platitudes. He stands for hate. We stand for love. Stronger together. Break down the barriers. Vague platitudes and cliches. Vote for us so we can do more establishment garbage. And people went, no, I'm just not doing that. You're for TPP. You bailed out Wall Street. You know, she's corrupt. What the fuck? So you need to fundamentally retool, restructure the Democratic Party from the ground up, and you have to do it in the image of Bernie Sanders. Because if you don't, then you're going to keep losing, and we're warning you of that right now. Are you going to listen, or are you going to shove your head in the sand? Okay. Next. The New York Times is reporting that the Obama administration is expanding the war on terror in his final months in office. That's great. So explain here. President Obama has quietly moved to expand U.S. military operations in Somalia. The administration has decided to deem the militant group Al-Shabaab to be part of the armed conflict that Congress authorized after the September 11th, 2001 attacks. Now, there's one giant problem with doing that. Al-Shabaab didn't even exist as an organization at the time. So, this is basically what happens when you don't care about the Constitution and you don't care about rule of law anymore, and you have extreme executive authority in the hands of one person, that now you don't need a declaration of war from Congress. You know, you don't need to stay within the guidelines that are laid out for you. You can just do whatever you want and say, look, I'm the president and this is how we're going to do it. And it went from, okay, let's declare war on Al-Qaeda, to, all right, well, not just Al-Qaeda, obviously the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, because the Taliban is housing Al-Qaeda, to, okay, well, now obviously ISIS grew out of that, so now we're going to add ISIS onto that. Okay, well, now we Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram, I mean, they're horrendous, so what are we going to do? We got to go after them, too. Okay, well, look, national boundaries. What are we going to, really? We're going to have a conversation about national boundaries? We have a unilateral ability to go anywhere we want to kill any people who we deem to be terrorists. It doesn't have to be proven, that you don't need evidence, just whoever we declare is terrorist. So, oh, look at that, boom, we blinked, and under a supposedly liberal Democratic president, we have seven interventions going on. We have an intervention in, sweet Jesus, I'm not even going to remember all the places, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, and I'm blanking on the rest. How bad it is. It's so bad that I, somebody who follows politics and follows the news day in and day out, can't even think of all the places where we're currently engaging in war. And as that's going on, and as they keep adding groups into this authorization of war that goes back to the fucking Bush years, we're wasting money on all that, and the fucking country is crumbling. How many times have we brought it up? We get a D from the Civil Society of Engineers, or Society of Civil Engineers. I forget how you say it. Somebody was mocking me one day when I messed it up. So our infrastructure is crumbling. We don't have clean water in Flint, Michigan. We have hundreds of thousands of homeless people. 50% of the American people make $30,000 or less every year. And this is the place that we're at. Just keep tacking on different groups that we declare terrorists. By the way, look, I get it. There are fucking terrorists in the world. But there used to be rule of law that mandated, okay, well, what's going on here? Well, you should really be under direct threat of attack before you actually wage a war. It, you know, this should be under international law. It should be approved by the United Nations. But we've decided, no, we get to attack whoever we want, whenever we want. And by the way, you're making the problem worse. If this was the effective strategy, it would already be the case that the jihadists are wiped out. They're not wiped out. They're more emboldened. They're stronger than ever. And they're stronger than ever because you keep killing civilians and further radicalizing them. And you made it so that if somebody loses their uncle or their brother or their aunt, they're more likely to say, well, you know what, at least the Taliban says they're going to fucking protect me from the big bad Americans who keep droning weddings over here. So in every way, it's been counterproductive. It's wasted money. It's wasted their civilian lives. It's wasted our military lives. And there's no end in sight. We just discussed yesterday the story about how they're creating a nerve center. They're creating a nerve center for endless war in the Middle East. I mean, why is nobody talking about that? You could watch CNN for weeks and they won't even mention the fact that we're at war right now. We still have officially a declared war in Afghanistan. In Iraq, we left for about 27 seconds and went right back in, and we're still engaged in a war there. I mean, any other nation, if you're engaged in a war, it would be fucking leading news every single day and clearly define, okay, what's the end goal? They don't even bother to pretend to have end goals anymore. I need you to think about how radical that really is. That's as radical as it gets, man. You don't even define what your mission is anymore. You don't even bother to put the window dressing over it or do the Kabuki theater or pretend like it's about freedom. And then there's the deep hypocrisy of, well, we're fighting these guys because they want to implement Sharia, as we give billions of dollars to Saudi Arabia, who officially implement Sharia, as we just allowed Brunei into the TPP, the trade deal, when they have Sharia. So this is, I mean, look, it's just unacceptable, and this is under a liberal Democratic president. I would hope if President Trump had randomly decided, hey, you know what, maybe Somalia, maybe we get more involved in Somalia and don't get congressional approval and just keep bombing there, that people would flip out. But I'm skeptical of anything motivating the American people on foreign policy to get out in the streets at this point, because we're so fucking jaded to the fact that our government will not stop fighting wars no matter what. All right, guys, let me take a quick break, and actually a final break, and then when we come back, I got President Jimmy Carter and Fox host Stuart Varney, and much more. So stay right there, y'all.
Turn up. like Mary Jane. Pussy in my mouth, pussy in my pinky ring. Neck, maybe do it in the back. But it's marijuana, keep it crack. Life's in my ass, I ain't doing nothing to the cash. Money, 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 we fast. Raped up and dripped out, keep the dream fast. Girl, put that thing up, fuck me, fuck rap. Days of a lie, so clap, clap the cake. Spreading your thighs, I'll pump up your brain. Hey, yeah.
Give me the trees and we can smoke it, yeah.
President Jimmy Carter, who's still doing his thing, man. Or he beat cancer, apparently. He's like 3,000 years old, but he's still doing his thing. So much love to former President Jimmy Carter. Okay. Let me set this up for you. President Jimmy Carter wrote an op-ed imploring Obama to take a stand on an important foreign policy issue. He said, "It has been President Obama's aim to support a negotiated end to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict based on two states living side by side in peace. That prospect is now in grave doubt. I am convinced that the United States can still shape the future of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict before a change in presidents, but time is very short. The simple but vital step this administration must take before its term expires on January 20th is to grant American diplomatic recognition to the state of Palestine, as 137 countries have already done, and help it achieve full United Nations membership." Okay, well, number one, that's unquestionably the right thing to do. Number two, I would be stunned if he did it, and I would be pleasantly surprised. So let's review real quick Obama's record on Israel. What did he just do? He gave them $38 billion. Let me repeat that number because it's unbelievable. $38 billion in military aid, knowing, hey, they're going to continue occupation, they're going to continue apartheid, they're going to continue expansion, and they're going to continue oppressing the Palestinians. So he did that knowing that was what they were going to do. So that what that would indicate to me is, well, look, I kind of gave up on being idealistic and trying to do the right thing. And it is what it is. Israel's our ally. They can get away with whatever they want to get away with. And here's here's an endless amount of money. So that's one thing. The other thing is he gave them Iron Dome. Iron Dome, of course, is the military defense shield, which makes it so that you can basically knock Hamas rockets out of the sky. Now, that's one, I'm totally fine with that one. I'm not fine with the $38 billion in military aid, knowing exactly what it's going to go for. But also, this is something, Obama has, taken his finger and gone, "Oh, Netanyahu, you better stop it. Let me tell you." And he looked both ways and say, "Okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to stop you?" So he's looked the other way. He's enabled them. He's emboldened them. But his rhetoric is still and it could all be kabuki theater. It could all be fake and just to look good on the international scene. But his rhetoric has been, okay, look, you can't give up on a two-state deal and you can't give up on trying to achieve peace. So he's had contradictory actions on this. Now, obviously, actions actually speak louder than words because his words are what contradict his actions, his words being we got to sit down at the table, we got to get a peace deal, we got to care about the Palestinians and the Israelis. But who knows? The only reason I'm saying who knows, I lean towards thinking, no, he's not going to do it. But the reason I say who knows is there are things he's done in his second term which have surprised me and have pleasantly surprised me. So, for example, he's broken the record on commutations and pardons. He just continuously, over and over again, released people for nonviolent drug offenses. That's definitely the right thing to do. After the first term, I didn't really expect him to do it, but he started to do it. Another thing, for example, the Cuba deal, I didn't necessarily expect that, but he did the right thing there. The Iran deal, I didn't necessarily expect that, but he did the right thing there. Raising the number of people who get overtime pay. Now, recently that's been slapped down by a court, which is fucking horrific. But, again, that was a positive thing I didn't necessarily expect him to do. So, is there an outside chance that he goes, you know what, we officially recognize a Palestinian state, and then just runs out the door? It's possible, man. It's possible. I mean, again, his actions would indicate the opposite, and there's no question that U.S. policy is still officially going to be to give smooth hand jobs to Israel, but it would be a bold move, and it would be the correct move, and it would basically be a giant step in the right direction, because most countries already fucking acknowledge a Palestinian state, and it's the U.S. and Israel and a few others who are like, no, we're not going to do it. We're not going to do it. And then I love how Israel pretends like they're still a partner in peace. Like, look, man, hey, it's not us, man. It's not us. It's those goddamn Palestinians. They're just being unreasonable. Well, really? How about the fact that the Palestinians proposed through Jordan at the UN a peace deal on the 1967 borders, which is only what you say it should be also? Doesn't count for some weird reason that we're not going to get into, but yeah, no, the Palestinians are not a partner in peace. Wait, what? You rejected that. Wouldn't that make you not a partner in peace? Wouldn't the fact that repeatedly now we learn that new settlements are being announced, wouldn't that make you not a partner in peace? I hate it's so disingenuous when they act like, oh, it's just the Palestinians are the problem. I mean, look, they're the ones who are unreasonable. They're unreasonable. We're totally reasonable. And, you know, hey, it's just that their values. I mean, what are you going to do? How are you going to negotiate with these monsters? I mean, look at their value system. They're just so backwards. But hold on. How can you make that argument when you're the one doing occupation, and they go, oh, they won't even recognize an Israeli state? I just told you, they proposed through the UN, at the UN, through Jordan, a deal which recognized an Israeli state and did the 67 borders. And you're literally not recognizing them as a state. So what are you talking about? Like, the wires are crossed, and everything is backwards. So they say, your values are crazy, and that's why we can't work with you, because you're savages. As Israel is doing the apartheid and occupation and expansion, and they keep building new settlements and taking more and more Palestinian lands. And the entire time they do it, they go, we're for liberal values. We're for liberal values, so it's okay. Wait, that's not liberal. That's the opposite of liberal. See, what they do is they rely on the fact that they're better on social policy, and they're better on stuff like gay rights, for example. And, you know, they're kinder to minorities in within the state of Israel. They rely on that fact to override all the other negative things they do. It's an old trick. You go, look, we stand for liberal values. Look, we treat gays much better than the fucking Palestinians do. Therefore, it's okay when we act illiberally and we do occupation and we do apartheid. So shut the fuck up. No, we're not going to shut up. The world is sick of it. We see through it. And there has to be peace in the region. And if you're not willing to accept it, well, we should force it on you. We shouldn't give you an option. I mean, this is why BDS is so important. Boycotts, divestments, and sanctions. Because it forced apartheid South Africa to do the right thing. Because eventually they said, look, economically now our hands are tied. We got to do the right thing. It's not an open question. Well, that's what we got to do to Israel, too. I'm not anti-Israel to say this. I'm pro-Israel because it makes it so that you have long-term sustainable peace. What we're doing right now is not going to lead to long-term sustainable peace. If anything, it's the opposite. There are going to be more attacks. There are going to be more terrorist incidents because you keep taking their goddamn land. Anybody would respond like that if you take their land. So I'd love to see Obama do it. I have my doubts. I'm lean to thinking he's not going to do it, but we'll hold on to that little bit of hope because he has gone rogue in a positive way in some senses in his second term. Okay. All right, now let me dive into The swamp of Fox News. We're talking a lot about swamps today, are we not?
Fox News host Stuart Varney went on the warpath against the Fight for 15 minimum wage protesters. Check it out.
Food chains and nearly 20 airports joining in a nationwide protest for higher pay and the right to unionize. They're calling the day the Day of Disruption. Joining me now to, well, weigh in on this is Stuart Varney, the host of Varney and Conway.
Are you familiar with the English expression sheer bloody-mindedness?
No, but I love it.
You know what I'm talking about.
And I will be using it all day. Yes, I do.
Look, I think that these days of, what is it, days of disruption or day of disruption, it amounts in some senses to just pure bloody-mindedness. You know you're going to hurt somebody, but you do it anyway, because that's what you do. This is really appalling. At 20 airports around the country, starting this morning, they're going to disrupt travel. At fast food restaurants across the country, they're going to try to disrupt operations. It's this Fight for 15. Number one, you disrupt people like that, you get no closer to your goal, because you really annoy a whole bunch of people. Your cause goes down the tubes. And number two, a $15 per hour minimum wage is a job killer. It's an opportunity killer, and everybody knows it. And they're still going to go out there and do it. Sheer bloody-mindedness, and I detest it. Is that strong enough?
It was dumb enough, that I know for sure. So let's go through some of this absolute nonsense here. Finally, I was waiting for this day, and it finally happened. Somebody put minimum wage workers in their place. I mean, those people, they needed to be knocked down a few pegs, always living on their goddamn high horse. They have so much going for them. So thank you, Stuart Varney, for being so brave and courageous. Just get up there and say, ah, you minimum wage workers, pesky, greedy bastards. Because that, I mean, when it comes down to it, that's the argument. Oh, they're so greedy. They're minimum wage workers. Minimum wage workers. Okay. So one of my favorite lines is, quote, you know you're going to hurt someone, but you do it anyway. So he's saying this about people protesting for a higher minimum wage. You know you're going to hurt somebody, but you're doing it anyway. Why are you doing it? Because it's bloody-mindedness, sheer or pure bloody-mindedness, whatever the fuck he said. You know what that line reminds me more of? You know you're going to hurt somebody, but you do it anyway. Paying minimum wage. If you pay somebody minimum wage, you know you're going to hurt somebody, but you do it anyway. Because they can't fucking live on minimum wage. Nobody can live on minimum wage. It's not a living wage. So you basically have a situation where it's wage slavery, and you go, I don't care. I know I'm going to hurt them. I'm going to do it anyway. I know I'm going to make them reliant on government programs who probably still can't even make up the difference to make them live at the bare minimum threshold to live a decent life. But, hey, whatever. I know I'm going to hurt them, but I'm going to do it anyway. So the people who pay the minimum wage, that applies to. But he's flipping it. These goddamn minimum wage workers, man. The thing we let these guys get away with, they're on their high horse. They know they're going to hurt people, but they do it anyway. It's unbelievable how he flips everything. And then he goes, it's a job killer. It's a job killer. Now, look, I've spoken before about how my preferred minimum wage policy is a federal law which mandates a living wage in every state. And I might even make it boil that down even more to every county. So in other words, the minimum wage in New York under this system, or excuse me, in New York City under this system, might be $23 or $24 an hour, because that's what you need to survive in New York. In Nebraska, rural Nebraska, it might be $11.33. So I would make it so that you actually have a living wage in each state or each county, and it's more nuanced, and that would avoid something like layoffs. Because it'd be more tailored to the specific region and what a living wage is in that region. So I hear the point of, oh, you know, you could lose some jobs if you do it. However, counterpoint, Australia has a higher minimum wage than $15 an hour, and they're doing just dandy. So you appear to just be incorrect, Stuart Varney. And furthermore, notice, no facts. See, that whole rant, scorn, anger, where are your facts? He doesn't have any facts. You want to know why? I was tweeting about this the other night. The minimum wage today is worth less than it was in the late 1960s. If it had just kept up with inflation from the late 1960s, it'd be over $10.50 an hour. If minimum wage kept pace with the earnings of the top 1%, it would be over $22 an hour. If minimum wage kept pace with worker productivity, it'd be over $21 an hour. So all these, when you look at the facts, it's clear that, if anything, minimum wage workers are artificially underpaid. Underpaid. But he makes the argument of, like, no, you want to pay them too much. You want to go do too much than what the market can bear. But that's not true. And also, at the end of the day, you're doing apologetics and you're rationalizing a system where people can work a full-time job and not make enough money to survive. That system does not self-justify, Stuart. The whole reason why we have an economic system is that it meets the needs of the people. Well, if that system is not meeting the economic needs of the people, and it's not, then that system doesn't even deserve to be the system. So, and also there's this idea, and you'll hear it from guys like Barney all the time, of like, well, just work harder. If you just work harder, you're not going to work harder. Okay, so let's live in his hypothetical fantasy bullshit world where everybody wakes up tomorrow. Everybody on the planet, everybody in the country, everybody who these laws apply to, they say, you know what? I'm going to work my way up the ladder. I'm going to bust my ass. What would happen if everybody did that? Every single person. Not everybody could get the promotion. You still need people to do those jobs that the minimum wage workers are earning. So even in your ideal scenario where everybody works hard and they try to get the promotion, not everybody can get the promotion. You're still going to need people to do those jobs. So then the question becomes, well, then what are we going to treat those people like, you know, human beings? And are we going to be decent human beings and set up a system where those people have a living wage? Nobody's asking for them to have a mansion and a fucking yacht, just a living wage. Are we going to give them a living wage, or are we not going to give them a living wage? His answer is, fuck them. Don't give them a living wage. They don't deserve it. Who cares about them? Work harder. Job killer. Sheer bloody-mindedness. Sheer bloody-mindedness. How? You're so callous. You're so callous for wanting a living wage. It's unbelievable. It's terrible. It's the worst thing ever. No, I believe the callous one is you, Stuart, and you've made that pretty clear. Okay. All right, I got one more with Stuart Varney here. This should be fun. Fox Business host Stuart Varney spoke to Judge Napolitano about Trump's call to punish flag burners. Let's see what they had to say here.
There are some people who will laugh at this next story and some people will not. Donald Trump says, he got a new tweet, burning the American flag should be illegal. Here is the tweet. Nobody should be allowed to burn the American flag, and if they do, there must be consequences. Perhaps loss of citizenship or a year in jail. Oh, he's laughing. Read it and weep, everybody, because the judge is here. What is wrong with a penalty for burning the American flag?
Two Supreme Court opinions that say I can burn my flag, I can't burn yours, I can't burn the government's, but burning the American flag is a form of protected freedom of speech. As reprehensible as it is, as demonstrative of a hatred of American values as it is, I fully agree with the president-elect on that, but you cannot prosecute for it. The reason I chuckled is the penalty of stripping citizenship has been prohibited in the United States of America since 1789. Since 1789.
We'll get a new Supreme Court and get a different ruling.
You'll need a new constitution, young man. Rather than the one under which he was elected president.
So Donald Trump is making a point, reaching over the heads of everybody.
He's making a point that he wants to stand up for veterans and he wants to stand up for people that want to fly the flag. And to the extent that that's a valid, admirable political point, great. But people cannot be prosecuted for expressing unpopular opinions. We know that.
Not yet.
Okay.
Never.
Okay.
Whoa. Okay, the way that ended was weird. I don't know how he meant it. Well, people can't be jailed for expressing unpopular opinions. And he goes, not yet. Was that like a not yet of, oh, I can't wait for those days? Or a not yet of like, yeah, those liberals are going to be the ones to do that. But that would be ironic because he just kind of was sympathetic to the idea of jailing people for unpopular opinions. He was kind of semi-defending Donald Trump there. So I don't know how he meant that. But either way, it's not good. Not yet. I can't wait to jail people for unpopular opinions. So look, this goes back to something I've been saying all along, and we covered the story yesterday. Donald Trump is the right-wing PC police. He's a right-wing social justice warrior. You know, hey, if you do something I don't approve of, if you say something I don't like, I'm going to ban you, or I'm going to throw you in jail. You burn a flag? I don't like that. I want to throw you in jail. Simple. You know, you say something about me that I don't like and you're in the media? Okay, well, you're on my blacklist. How about that? You make a joke I don't like? Bill Maher? I'm going to sue you. The Onion? You wrote a satire piece that I don't like? I'm going to sue you. So there's nothing, he doesn't care about free speech, he doesn't care about free expression, he doesn't care about the Constitution, he doesn't care about any of it. And now you see some people on Fox, they're like, oh, they're trying so hard, okay, got to be kind to him somehow, oh, let's all see, no, he cares about the veterans, that's what he cares about. Really, is that why he did the veteran scam earlier in the campaign, remember that? I gave them $8 million, actually you didn't, and we have the records, and hey, writes a check, gives them, no, see, now I did, so shut up. Some of Arnie's quotes there. What is wrong with a penalty for burning an American flag? Oh, I don't know. Freedom? That's the whole point. The whole point is, oh, they're doing something. You might not like it. File that under don't give a shit. That's what a free country is about. You could have a disagreement with somebody. You could say, hey, you know, you're wrong. You're reprehensible. You're this, you're that. But you don't get to lock them up for dissenting, and that is nothing but an expression of dissent. So what's wrong with locking somebody up for burning the American flag? It's like saying what's wrong with basic freedom, because that's what it is. And then he also said, well, get a different Supreme Court and get a different ruling. Like, oh, okay. So get a Supreme Court that's authoritarian and doesn't care about free speech and free expression, and then get a different ruling. Problem solved. Good to know Stuart Varney. That quickly, if you have a leader that he likes, authoritarianism is totally cool. And by the way, flip it. If you had, let's say Hillary Clinton got elected, and you had conservatives say, you know what, I'm tired of this. We elected Obama twice, and we elected Hillary Clinton. I'm going to burn the flag. Then they burn the flag. Would these guys be having the same conversation? Look, hey, maybe President Clinton locks them up. Maybe that's the right thing to do. Maybe if Hillary Clinton tweeted that, if she got elected, they're burning flags to protest her, and she was like, you should be locked up for burning a flag. Would they be like, it's cool. No, we're on her side. You know, she should lock people up for dissenting. No, they'd say, oh, this is the most American thing you could do. It's freedom. And that gets to the last point, which is, I don't agree with, Napolitano even says there, it shows like a hatred of America if you do it. I don't agree with that. In fact, I vehemently disagree with that. Because if you burn the flag, it could be specifically to protest something your government did. So if you're burning the American flag during the Iraq War, what you're saying is, I don't agree with the Iraq War. I think the Iraq War was a bad idea. It was an offensive war waged against a country that didn't attack us, and hundreds of thousands of civilians died. We set up a worldwide torture regime. It broke the Middle East and had ISIS rise up out of the flames. If you burn the American flag in protest of the war in Iraq, I think that is more American than if you don't burn an American flag. See, to these guys, patriotism, it's all symbolic. It's all like, oh, I pray to Jesus and fly an American flag and have a fucking NRA bumper sticker on my car. That's not patriotism. That's douchiatism. to actually care about your country, real patriotism is understanding that you live in a country that allows you to burn a flag without locking you up for it. It's understanding you live in a country that embraces that freedom. Not, hey, if you do it, we're going to lock you up, and that's the right thing to do. That's just like every authoritarian and any authoritarian regime in human history. We're supposed to be better than that. So if you're burning the American flag and you're, you know, saying, and it's 1959 and you're in segregated Mississippi and you say, I'm going to burn this because this flag don't represent me,
we want it to represent me, I'm going to burn it until the situation is right. That is highly patriotic. If you burn the flag to protest the Iraq War, that's highly patriotic. You burn it to protest Guantanamo Bay, that's highly patriotic. So it's not this idea of the symbols represent everything. This isn't a religion, bitch. This is a country that we can try to keep improving to create a more perfect union. And how do you do that but through criticism? That's why the comment has been made before, and it's correct. Dissent is the highest form of patriotism because you're saying, I want to make my country better. I want to stop being an empire with 800 military bases where we waste $100 billion on it every year. I want to make my country better. I want to stop it from being a corporatocracy. I want to pay workers a living wage. That's making your country better. That's not unpatriotic. That is the very definition of patriotism. Okay. All right, let me give you some more here. I got two more for you, and I think you'll like them. One of them is a little sad, very sad. The other one is funny. Let's do the funny one. Well, actually, you know what? Real quick. I'm seeing there's a slight issue with the camera. So I want to fix that. So let me fix that real quick, and then we'll come back, and we'll get into it. I'll give you a little tease. One of them involves porn. So you should be happy. The porn story when we come back. Stay right there, guys. Curious, I actually have a, I'm training an editor. Training an editor, so that's huge, that's big. And also considering, you know, getting somebody who can, like, direct, I think, like, do the kind of the directing of the show, that would be interesting. But editor, I already got, already training. So that's a huge step forward, so I don't have to spend like 8 zillion hours a day on that. Although at first it's starting off slow, and then we'll see later on if I expand the hours and stuff. But anywho, I say that because it's such a classic secular talk thing of like, I need to go because I need to fix the camera. All right, let's go to the Independent and talk a little bit about sex. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about blah, blah, blee. The Independent is reporting on a sad story coming out of the UK. They explain, a new bill will, if successful, ban huge swaths of sex acts from UK porn. The digital economy bill looks to ban anything that wouldn't be allowed on a commercially available DVD, banning things including female ejaculation and the sight of menstrual blood from all pornographic videos. While there are no strict guidelines as to what acts and images can't be shown on commercial DVDs, adult film producers have found that they have had to cut almost all kinds of non-conventional videos from the films, from their films. Such restrictions include the four-finger rule, which limits the number of digits that can be placed into any orifice while on video. The digital economy bill has so far been almost entirely criticized for its age verification clauses, which require any porn website to check whether its users are over 18. That's likely to lead to a database of viewing habits being held by companies or by the government, which experts have warned could easily be hacked and exposed. Yeah. So my buddy had mentioned this to me. I didn't read the articles yet, but my buddy had sent me a text talking about this. And it didn't even occur to me that, oh, yeah, hold on. In order for them to really verify, okay, these, and nobody looking at this porn site is under the age of 18, you would need a database. You would need them to be able to track it. And if they track it, then they're tracking everybody's porn habits. And nobody wants that. Who wants that? Yeah, let me have the government look in on everything I'm looking at on my computer. No, that would be a police state beyond imagination. That's horrible. And by the way, I don't even agree with the idea that under 18, that number's got to be lower to at least 16. Like, really? You're a 16-year-old guy and you're not looking at porn online? I mean, please, what percentage of 16-year-old boys are looking at porn online? I'm guessing way over 50%. Way over 50%. So, first of all, that number should be lowered. Second of all, that's an undue burden on the company. There's no way they can verify it without having a giant database that tracks everybody's porn habits, which is obviously a greater evil. So, I mean, people's privacy would be gone. And then furthermore, dude, seriously, like, that's how much you're going to regulate this stuff? Now, let me be clear. Some of that stuff is gross to me, too. Fucking, like, fisting and shit. I don't want to see that. I don't want to see fisting. I don't want to see your gaping butthole. It's gross. No interest. But just because I'm not into it doesn't mean other people aren't into it, and it doesn't mean that that's so horrific the government needs to stop it. Like, okay, you do realize as long as we're talking about consensual sex here, which we are, it's none of your goddamn business. I don't give a fuck how weird your kinks get, and there are some weird ones out there, but that's irrelevant. If it's consenting adults, it doesn't matter how gross or strange or out there the kink is, be my guest, go right ahead. And then they're trying to regulate people's sex lives. No, you want to know how you regulate it? No rape. No forced sex. It's got to be consensual. Outside of that, I don't care. You do whatever the hell you want, even if I would vomit when I looked at it. But vomiting would be a weird response because the vomit would turn some people on because that's how weird some people get, but whatever. So if that's your thing, I don't want to shut down the fucking parts of the website that cater to that. So, and again, it's a weird thing to come out here and defend, like, gross perversions. But the point is not to defend the gross perversions. It's to defend the freedom that goes hand in hand with that. So as long as it's consensual, it shouldn't fucking matter, but they're trying to get too much involved. Like, female ejaculation, that's not even, like, you can find shit like that on totally mainstream porn sites. And that's the other thing, is like, so they could start out with the most extreme things, like, well, we got to get rid of that. And then eventually you get more, you know, you go less extreme, and then where does it end? Like, well, I mean, come on, we got to ban anal, right? It's unsanitary. No more anal porn. Nobody could watch anal porn because that's really unsanitary, and if you're doing it without a condom, you know, it's possible for disease to spread, and, like, there are all these arguments you can make, but those arguments are bullshit at the end of the day because it's about the freedom to engage in those things. As long as these people are doing it consensually, to regulate it, I mean, you want to talk about government that's far too big. And by the way, I don't even know who's behind this. Is it the conservatives who are behind it? Is it the liberals who are behind it? I don't give a fuck who's behind it. I'm against it either way. because the liberals can make the argument of like, oh, this is exploitation of women, which is horrible, so we have to stop it and do it by law. And the conservatives can make it all family values, we don't want our kids looking at this, blah, blah, blah. Like, there might be a meeting of the minds on the right and the left. To be clear, I don't know who's proposing this and who's supporting this and whatnot. But, you know, the people who are correct about it would be civil libertarians, social libertarians, people who are like, you do whatever you want as long as you're not hurting anybody. In fact, on stuff like this, I think it's crazy to not be in that camp, because how long until they come for, you know, the thing that you like, even if it's not in the realm of sex, even if it's like in Saudi Arabia, they ban chess because the fucking Grand Mufti, just hilarious every time I say it, Mufti, he's like, it's a waste of time. What does that mean? He doesn't like it. So he's like, I'm going to ban it for everybody. Well, that's stupid. That's idiotic. Why? That doesn't matter. Nobody cares if you like it or don't like it, and they shouldn't care. Maybe some people do, but most people, you're just taking away their freedom. They banned Pokemon, too. This is the same kind of thinking. I know that's a stretch because it's like, okay, some really extreme porn stuff. But again, as long as it's consensual, where's the line? Once you agree, well, there is a line somewhere where we just regulate based off of opinion and what we think is wholesome and not, well, then that line can move, and it's up to anybody's interpretation. You know, my take on it is, it's irrelevant what your opinion is. It's irrelevant what your subjective take on it is. The only thing that's not okay is if it's non-consensual, because then there's a crime being committed, and it's not about free will, and it's not about somebody's individual rights. You're taking away the rights of somebody else. That's the only place where you draw a line. Okay, final segment of the day. A Moroccan TV show did a segment teaching women how to cover up the bruises from their husbands beating them.
بالنسبة للأخضر هو باش غادي نغطيو به الجهة اللي كتكون شوية فيها الحمرار دونك كتكون حمراء هي باش غادي نغطيو داك الجهة اللي كتكون حمراء دونك كيف كتشوفوا هكا هو في نفس الوقت حنا كنعرفوا بان فاش كتكون الضرب كيكون شويه هنا كتكون هاد الجهه هادي مازال حساسه يمكن لكم كاع ما تبركوش دونك غير بحال هكا بدي بان صفراء
Yeah, that's fucked up. That's gross because it's a normalization of domestic violence. I mean, apparently it's common enough where they feel the need to do this. But that shouldn't be the case. Your segment should be teaching. Your segment shouldn't be teaching women to cover up their bruises. Your segment should be teaching men not to beat the shit out of women. It's like that's just it's casually accepted to the point where now the onus is on the woman to well, I mean, you gotta look good in society the day after he beats you, so. That's where the issue is. Fixing the look of it afterwards, not the fact that he did it and he shouldn't do it, and maybe there should be a fucking giant campaign to change that. So this is why we need feminism. I mean, you know, feminists get a bad rap nowadays. Some of it merited because there's this goofy third wave version of it. But there's no denying that worldwide, yeah, there needs to be a giant feminist revolution. Because if you don't have it, yes, there are the default position in many societies is a patriarchal system. And that can be brought about through culture, or that can be brought about through religion and fundamentalism. Or it could be brought about simply by based on the fact that, you know, men historically they have more muscle mass, they're more testosterone, and women have been viewed, oh, the servile role, if you will. Well, it's wrong to just assume that it needs to be like that. The woman's job is to be in the kitchen, is to be the homemaker, and that's the end of the conversation. No, women should have all the same rights as men. They should be able to choose what they want to do with their life, if they want to go out in the workforce, if they want to stay home, whatever, if they want to do a mix. It's all on them. They could be single, whatever. So there should be no stigma against women, and they should be treated equally to men, and
the casual acceptance of stuff like this and the casual acceptance of, for example, women not being able to drive in Saudi Arabia and forced veiling laws and stuff like that, that all needs to change, that all needs to be reversed, and you basically need a feminist revolution and a giant tsunami push of this ideology and this mindset that they're totally equal to men, and the law should be clear about that, and they should be protected. And it's not the case that if you're in a marriage, your wife is like your property. Because in many societies, that's just the, if you bring that up to them, like, oh, like your wife, so you can do whatever you want to her, you can fucking rape her, you can beat her up, and she's like your property, right? In many societies, the response is like, well, yeah, duh, I mean, I married her. No, not duh, not duh. Still an individual with free will and human rights, and that should be reflected in the law, and that should be reflected in the culture more broadly. All right, guys, I'm out of time. I love you, baby. We'll see you tomorrow for an awesome Thursday show. Mwah, peace.